Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane while she's away on vacation. The F-22 fighter jet is at the center of a debate on how best to spend taxpayer money to protect the country. The aircraft was first built in the 1980s to counter the threat posed by the Soviet Union. The U.S. has never flown the planes in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and friends of the fighter say they're needed for national security and to save jobs. Foes say they're a waste of money. Joining me in the studio to discuss the politics of the F-22, Winslow Wheeler of the Center for Defense Information, Mackenzie Eaglin of the Heritage Foundation, and Mark Thompson covers defense matters for Time Magazine. Welcome. Nice to have you all.
Thanks.
Give us a call, as always, 1-800-883-8850, 433-8850, and our email address, drshow@wamu.org. You can find us on Facebook. Send us a tweet. We want to hear what you have to say about this subject. Mark Thompson, key vote today, about noon, just a couple of hours from now, in the U.S. Senate. An amendment from bipartisan amendment, Senator McCain, Senator Levin, the ranking Democrat chairman of the Armed Services Committee. Tell us what this vote's about.
The vote basically is to add $1.75 billion for another seven F-22s that the president, the secretary of defense, the leaders of the Air Force, and both senators who are in charge of the Armed Services Committee say not that we don't need, but the money can be better spent elsewhere. Mm-hmm. On the other side, you've got folks who say, listen, we need these airplanes for a future kind of war. And hey, by the way, we're in the middle of a recession, and there are 25,000 jobs spread across 44 states that depend on continued production of the F-22.
Now, President Obama, Mackenzie, has threatened to veto this bill. Why do you think he picked this issue to try to make his first significant veto threat?
I do think it was a knee-jerk veto and almost a laughable one, particularly because this is considered an unfunded requirement by the military. And going back through the
last... What do you mean by unfunded requirement?
That the leaders of the Air Force have said that the military requirement for the jet is 243 F-22s. That's how much they need, but all they can afford are 187. Going back through the last several decades, I can't find another president who had such a knee-jerk reaction and vetoing an unfunded military requirement. However, that being said, I do think that the president is being pushed largely by the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, and in part because the F-22 in the secretary's mind is largely symbolic of this larger shift in priorities that he's trying to make within the defense budget for fiscal year 2010. And if he prevails on this, in theory, he will probably win all his other subsidiary arguments for much smaller programs for a lot less money.
Secretary Gates, of course, was a holdover from Republican administration and a lot of credibility with Republicans on the Hill where you worked for many years. Is this one of the reasons why Barack Obama picked Gates to stay on for just this sort of fight?
Sure is. It strengthens his position considerably. I have to fundamentally disagree with Mackenzie. Requirement studies are a dime a dozen in the Department of Defense. We've had requirement study for 750 F-22s, 381, 270 or so. Give me a number and I'll give you a requirement study for it. The fact that there is or is not a requirement study for this airplane at 187 is completely meaningless to me.
But why do you think Obama decided to make this his first big veto threat?
Because Gates encouraged him to. Congress is shredding Gates's 50 decisions on the big ticket items. They've already shredded him on the C-17.
These are 50 decisions on
restructuring. Right. In April 6th, he made 50 decisions. About half a dozen of them were major program cancellations, C-17, F-22, T-SAT satellite, CSAR helicopter, and a few others. The last bill through Congress, the supplemental, added eight C-17s for $2.2 billion. That opened the barn door. Gates didn't fight that. His spokesman even endorsed it.
So this is really you agree that in many ways this is a symbolic vote. It's not just about F-22s, but about his whole program.
It's part of a process where Congress is chewing away at Gates' decisions, unraveling them. Much to his credit, Gates is now fighting this F-22 decision big time. It's a major fight. The headcounts have been all over the place. It's going to be probably going to be close. I don't know. But my final point is that on the substance, Gates and Obama are exactly right. The F-22 is a real problem. It is a classic example of why our Air Force is today smaller, older, less ready to fight at vastly increased cost.
Well, let's talk about some of the dimensions of this aircraft, Mark Thompson. I want to sketch out both the negative and the positive arguments, but the negative first. As we said earlier, it was designed in the 1980s for a foe, the Soviet Union, that never created a comparable high-tech aircraft. And it's never flown over Iraq and Afghanistan. Talk about the argument that this is a plane that's not needed anymore for American security.
Well, as John Lehman, the former Navy Secretary, wrote over the weekend in the Wall Street Journal, the Chinese, which is the big threat that this plane is designed to confront, will never be able to cyber attack it because it uses IBM code from 1983, which sort of tells you it really isn't state of the art, even though it's a fifth generation airplane. It's designed for air superiority. For a half a century, this country has had air superiority. The last American soldier killed on the ground by an enemy aircraft was 60 years ago in Korea. But the American military today wants air dominance, not mere superiority. So this aircraft has got a lot of gimcracks and gewgaws and stealth and thrust vectoring and fusion of intelligence that really make it the hottest thing in the sky. The question is, of what use is that in the type of war we're now facing?
Mackenzie, what is that counterargument? Why do you and supporters of this plane think it's still useful despite this argument that it's designed to fight a foe that no longer threatens American security?
Well, again, back to Air Force leadership, who I think are the bosses on this topic, they said that the F-22 is the most capable design with two times the fighting speed and altitude of its counterpart platform, the Joint Strike Fighter, the F-35. Its supercruise ability is critical for combating air and surface threats, not just air-to-air. And its radar offers three times the coverage of an F-15. Now, that being said, Chief of Staff of the Air Force has said that the traditional margins of U.S. military technology are diminishing across the board. It takes 20 years to put a plane in the sky from the first time you want one.
But what about the argument that if you look at what the threats to American security have been, where has America fought wars in the last decade in Iraq and Afghanistan? And this plane has never flown in those theaters. And the argument is that shows that it's not relevant. What's the counterargument?
Well, actually, military commanders, including the Central Commander General Petraeus, now and his successor, asked to employ the F-22 over Iraq, in fact, in 06. And they were told that what's called no, they were told no due to what's called strategic dislocation or the perception of escalation by Iran's leaders. To me, that bolsters the case for the F-22. If our defense leaders are worried about what message is sent when the world's most capable fighter jet is deployed, that therefore is the world's most capable fighter.
Now, another issue, Winslow, that comes up a lot is the maintenance and the cost overruns on this plane. So we have several emailers writing in saying that the skin surface can be damaged by rain. The maintenance costs have far exceeded a lot of the estimates. One estimate I saw is it cost $44,000 an hour to fly this plane. How does that factor into the mix in terms of the decisions that are being made in the Senate today?
It's one of the major reasons why the F-22 is a bad idea. It's the most complex fighter in the sky. It's the heaviest fighter in the sky. It's the most difficult to maintain fighter in the sky. There's been lots of back and forth on this issue of how much it costs to maintain it. And the Air Force threw some fog in when it tried to respond to a Washington Post article last week. Lockheed, who pretends it's not lobbying on this issue, has also thrown in some fact sheets to Capitol Hill, which is full of, I guess the appropriate word is bovine scatology on this. The numbers in the Air Force fact sheet are that the F-22 is $49,000 per hour to operate. The F-15 is about 30. Neither of those numbers count all the costs. The non-flying hour costs for the F-22 skyrocket its costs per airplane to multiples of the F-15, let alone the F-16.
And what about this argument, Mackenzie, that it's a badly designed plane, it continues to have enormous maintenance problems, which of course also adds to its cost, and its inefficiency as a weapon?
Well, the cost per variable flying hour is roughly equivalent to the F-15 in 2008 dollars, $117,000 per hour. The F-22 is about $19,000, so that's pretty close. And the costs over time are coming down as the maintenance crews are learning more about the airplane. I mean, let's face it, any fifth-generation platform, whether it's a DDG-1000 Zumwalt destroyer for the Navy or this for the Air Force, is going to be expensive. And this is due to a lot of things, including tremendous research and development costs that went into this.
And isn't this part of the argument, Mark, that it is expensive and that is to some extent this is a zero-sum game? And a part of what Senator McCain is arguing and Secretary Gates is arguing is that because of its expense and because of the nature of our warfare, we've got to put our money in different systems.
Yeah, it's very true. In the last week, there have been a couple of interesting things, and I'm not saying they're related, but you should be aware they're happening. Yesterday, Secretary Gates said, I'm increasing the number of soldiers in our army by 22,000.
Right.
And that money is going to come from inside my budget. It might go for F-22s, but it might go for these soldiers we need. At the same time over the weekend, an F-15E crashed in Afghanistan, killing both pilots aboard. We've been told that that's due to mechanical problems. That suggests this airplane either was too old, wasn't maintained properly. I mean, but the fact of the matter is that we have bought 187 of these airplanes, and the question is, are we going to keep buying more, or are we going to just stop here?
We're going to talk more about that question in just a minute as soon as we come back. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in for Diane, and today our subject is the F-22, a fight that will be playing out in Congress just in a few hours over funding for that weapon system. With me to discuss this issue, Winslow Wheeler of the Center for Defense Information. He's also editor of a new book, America's Defense Meltdown. Mackenzie Eaglin is with us. She's from the Heritage Foundation, and Mark Thompson covers defense for Time magazine. Mark, we were just, before the break, we were talking about this question of priorities, and it seems to me that a lot of what this debate, underlying this debate, is an analysis of where the threats are going to come from to America in the next generation. It's really not just about hardware at all, but really there's a much larger debate about trying to sense what the geopolitical landscape is going to look like.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting, Steve, when you look at the fact that the big boogeyman on the horizon is China. Well, go into any Walmart in this country, and 98% of what's in Walmart comes from China. How does that change the tilt about the prospect of going to war? I mean, that's the notion here, that what's the utility of military force? This week, the Air Force is unveiling its unmanned aircraft strategy for the next 40 years. And they are saying, as we're now seeing over Pakistan and Afghanistan, that unmanned Predators, Reapers, Global Hawks, and different sorts of aircraft, which are a lot cheaper than any manned platform, are likely to be playing a bigger and bigger role in the U.S. military. And that's got to lead to questions about, gee, do we need more $350 million fighters?
Now, Mackenzie, Secretary Gates, a Republican, has said repeatedly,
We talked earlier about how, to some extent, this is a symbolic vote. But he's also said, if we can't get this one right, we can't get anything right. He has really placed his whole reputation as a defense expert over many, many years on this decision. Why do you think he's wrong?
Well, there's a fundamental divide with Secretary Gates's worldview and many of those in Congress, and what he's looking out ahead 20 years and basically coming back to today's budget and saying that the future will look largely like the present. A lot of irregular warfare, counterinsurgency, Iraq's and Afghanistan's, essentially. And many members of Congress want to emphasize, I think rightly so, that the military doesn't simply fight and win wars. That is very important, and as a superpower, we need to be able to do that. But they also exist to deter and influence future actors. And this doesn't mean just in a combat situation, but discourage investment in their own next generation systems, for example, or influence a political competition with a major power like China, for example. So while our disagreement may appear to be overspending in budgets, it's really about strategy. And the military has sized its force on the assumption that the United States has to be able to conduct two, you know, nearly simultaneous wars. Secretary Gates is going to throw that out, and he's going to say we really only need to be able to do one.
Now, in addition, as you well know, Winslow, this is not just a debate about strategy, which is very important, but it's also a debate about domestic economics. It's no accident that the leading proponent of funding, Senator Saxley Chambliss of Georgia, the home state of Lockheed Martin, which is the main contractor for this plane. And the estimates have been that there are as many as 25,000 direct jobs, 70,000 to 90,000 indirect jobs. Talk about the importance of jobs, and which is not just about the F-22. This has been a long-standing issue through the whole history of weapons procurement.
Congress has a long history with pork, earmarks, congressional interest items, call them what you want. Lockheed says that there's 90,000 jobs in this airplane and 44 states involved. That needs to take with a real grain of salt. That's indirect jobs. Maybe it's the 25,000 Lockheed says are involved in this airplane. Maybe not. Some of the DOD numbers are lower. When I worked for Senator Domenici from New Mexico, we had GAO do a study on just how many jobs our New Mexico defense budget pork added for the state's economy, and the results were startling. In some cases, the money passed through the state through Albuquerque to be spent somewhere else. In other cases, it was a tiny number of hand-touch labor jobs.
But isn't it true that the members of the Senate believe this means jobs? I mean,
absolutely.
Senator Dodd, a leading liberal Democrat, Connecticut is a home state of the company that makes the engines for this F-22, is one of the leading proponents of it.
Here's how bad it is. They're crazed with these earmarks, and we should look at the F-22 as one of them. As Senators Levin and McCain very astutely pointed out their amendment, and it's a very straightforward, decent amendment, the funding mechanism for these seven F-22s is not to add money to the procurement budget. It is to raid money from other accounts. The accounts they raid are the operation and maintenance account for $850 million.
That's back to the question we were talking about.
Training and depot maintenance, just the kind of thing you need more of. One final point here. We are at a disgraceful low in the amount of training time we give to our pilots in the air. F-22 pilots get from 10 to 12 hours per month in the air in air combat training. That's about a half or a third of what it should be. If Saxby Chambliss were real about being pro-defense, he would double, then triple the amount of time for F-22 pilot training. Instead, he's raiding that money, so he'll have even less.
Well, that is part of the argument that Senator McCain and others are making, as we were talking earlier, Mark, that to some extent this is a zero-sum game. And if you're going to take money for the F-22, you're going to take it away from something else. But what about Senator Dodd's argument that, hey, we just spent billions and billions of dollars bailing out the banks. We've spent billions and billions of dollars bailing out the auto industry. Why not spend money helping in the aerospace industry, which also creates jobs? What's your answer to that argument?
Well, Secretary Gates, from his perspective, answered it at yesterday's briefing, where he basically said, listen, We're not stopping aerospace. Mm-hmm. In fact, we are gunning up the F-35, which is sort of a, you know, a smaller, slightly less capable airplane than the F-22, but we're going to buy a lot more of them. We're going to buy them for the Marines. We're going to buy them for the Navy. Our allies are going to buy them. That's going to be a $1 trillion program. It overwhelms the F-22 in terms of its size. And Gates asserts that more jobs will be created building the F-35 within 2 or 3 years than currently are being saved for the F-22. So, of course, Senator Dodd is interested in engines and Pratt & Whitney, and guess what? A lot of those engines will come from his neck of the woods.
And one of the interesting things here, Mackenzie, and this is hardly a new issue, I remember covering Congress many, many years ago when the B-1 bomber was an issue, and visiting the office of late Congressman Joseph Addabbo, who was a Democrat from New York. And he had on his wall a map where with red pins indicating all of the subcontractors who provided some parts and some jobs to the B-1. And it was a forest of red pins in the entire country. Isn't this part of the strategy of a company like Lockheed Martin or any defense contractor to spread out these jobs just so when you get a vote like today, you have a lot of members of Congress who have a vested interest in continuing the program?
Sure, I think that's a fair point. I mean, there's the Iron Triangle includes politicians as well, who have some parochial interests and some larger. The fundamental responsibility of government is to protect Americans. So, you know, there is a security element here. But the popular perception is that the F-22 line, Senator Chambliss wants to keep it going to save Lockheed Martin jobs. But a couple of things. Boeing builds a full one-third of this this fighter, and these are in completely different states.
There are two liberal Democratic senators from Washington who will vote for this money for exactly that reason.
But the 2010 budget that the president submitted to Congress taken en masse would lead to the deliberate consolidation of the United States tactical aircraft fighter production to just one manufacturer. Ironically, that's Lockheed. They're actually a big winner overall. You know, traditionally, the U.S. has maintained 2 or 3 active fighter production lines at any given time, and just shifting down to one is pretty startling at the same time that Russia and China have 12 fighter and bomber production lines open today. And a final point is that these two jets do share about 75% of the supplier industrial base, but there is a 3-year bathtub before we're fully ramping up on the Joint Strike Fighter. So
the F-35.
That's right. And so the work is already drying up, according to the Air Force. So jobs are being lost now, not in some distant future.
And Winslow, this is one of the reasons why one of the key players here are some labor unions, because everybody thinks of the lobbying for the aerospace industry as coming from the big defense contractors. But one of the key players here are the unions that represent the workers in these plants.
Right. And they have real concerns about their livelihood, especially these days. The University of Massachusetts at Amherst did a fantastic study on the efficiency of defense spending for creating jobs vis-a-vis education, healthcare, transportation, even tax cuts. DOD spending in the procurement budget was the worst generator of jobs. You get more jobs and better jobs if you spend the money on education, for example. Doesn't have the high overhead, doesn't have the high material costs, has a quicker payout rate. And so if your big interest is jobs, don't spend it in the defense procurement budget.
But when you talk about a legislative fight like the one we're seeing today, Mark, you have one side that is very focused and motivated, members of Congress who are protecting jobs, unions who are protecting jobs. They're not thinking about the cost efficiency of jobs that might be created in education. They're thinking about their constituents and their factories in their districts today. And the history of a lot of this is that the highly motivated forces are often win a fight like this because the larger forces of restructuring are not as motivated.
Yeah, they're much more diffuse, and that's a good point. Of course, once you bring in the threatened presidential veto, I think that tends to level the playing field, and that's why Gates, I think, yesterday and last week in Chicago was so hard-nosed about the fact that you know, let's keep our eye on the ball here. Jobs are going to continue. You know, whether or not, we're getting this $1.75 billion within the Pentagon budget. We're not adding, as Winslow pointed out, another new $1.75 billion. So plainly, the defense budget is going to stay in the same size. It's going to continue to generate jobs to whatever rate that is. There's going to be no net loss of jobs. What's going to happen is jobs are going to shift. And, you know, indeed, there may be fewer tactical.
And there would be, and there might be a lag, as McKenzie was pointing out, a period before the next production line ramps up.
But let's keep our eye on the ball here. Indeed, we may be going. I mean, when I started covering defense 30 years ago, there were six or seven assembly lines doing tactical jets. Now there's one, two, maybe three. Well, guess what? General Atomics in San Diego, California, is building unmanned vehicles. They didn't exist in this realm 5 or 10 years ago. So that's what happens.
But it's almost always the case that people defend the status quo. They defend, the unions defend the jobs that they have now. The members of Congress defend the jobs they have now as opposed to the jobs they might have in the future.
And they use rhetoric to do that. And if you listen to the rhetoric, I've been around long enough to remember the bomber gap. Guess what? It didn't exist. The missile gap. Guess what? It didn't exist. Now they're talking about the fighter gap.
Let's turn to some emails here. And a lot of people want to get in on this conversation. We've had a number of emailers. Apparently, one of the concerns our listeners have is that there's been a lot of stories, McKenzie, about the coating on this plane. It's stealth technology, which is designed to deflect radars. You can explain it better than I can. But there's been a lot of reports that it actually doesn't do well in the rain. Hold your answer. I'm going to say you're now listening. I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And please give us your answer now. What's about? Well, I had to do that for the stations. Tell me about the rain.
Well, the chief of staff of the Air Force has openly said that the F-22, when it's within close visual range, loses some of its edge. He's again reiterated this point that across the board and across the military services, the U.S. technological overmatch, so to speak, is losing its traditional margins. We are in fact reducing those capabilities relative to other countries that are developing them as well. The stealth coating is just one of these features.
Let me read.
There's a different issue here, though. There's a major lawsuit about the misfabrication of the stealth coating on the F-22. It's cracking. It is abrading. Rain isn't so much the problem. It's having serious problems. And John Young, the former acquisitions czar for the Bush administration, pointed out this is going to need major repairs. There's a serious problem there. Remember.
Well, this adds to the cost per flying hour, right, that we're talking about.
That we've not yet observed.
Steve,
cost to come.
Think of it. Think of the airplane as covered in suede. You know, that's basically what it is, okay? And it gets wet and it doesn't work so well. But the F-22 has problems. I mean, John Young was on the Hill late last year complaining that to bring the existing 187 F-22s up to the highest level that the newest ones are is going to cost an additional $8 billion. So that's just to bring the first 100 up to the newest 87. That's real money.
Let me read this email from Neil, writes to us from University Heights, Ohio. As a pilot with an engineering background, I am extremely impressed with the technology the F-22 represents. Unfortunately, the F-22 has no practical mission now or on the horizon, and Mr. Gates is absolutely right that we need to put our military expenditures toward providing solutions to the real problems that we face. What do you think, McKenzie? How do you answer that?
Well, I think that the U.S. can take for granted the traditional military primacy that we've enjoyed since the end of World War II. And if you don't invest in those next-generation systems, they will go away and you will lose control of the seas or air superiority in this case. The F-35 is not a replacement for the F-22. They were designed to operate in tandem, shoes and shoelaces. F-22s clear the skies for everything, including unmanned systems, to then come in and operate freely, not just from, again, air threats, but also advanced surface-to-air missiles. So you need an adequate number of these planes. 187 really only gives you about 100 tails in the air at any given time. Some are used for training and testing. Others are in maintenance. And 100 just isn't enough for even one theater to operate your air superiority force, much less two.
And let's read an email from David Williams, who writes to us, "I'm not a fan of the Pentagon budget. I do like the position our military power affords us in the world," which is part of the argument you were making. "Forget jobs. I don't think maintaining jobs is a realistic argument. However, consider this. The reason our missions over the last 20 years have gone as well as they have is America's absolute dominance of the skies. If we have dominance of the skies, the fighting our ground troops do gets a lot easier. Our forces have not faced a major enemy air power since Korea. The F-22 is not for today," David writes. "The F-22 buys air dominance for our troops in the future." What do you think, Mr.?
I don't buy it. The F-22 is an attempt to realize a long-standing dream on the part of the radar bureaucracy in the Air Force. And I'm saying it in crude terms, but it's what it amounts to. This long-range, beyond-visual-range, radar-directed air warfare has been tried time and time again, and it's failed time and time again. Further, the radar, even the low-probability of intercept radar that the F-22 has, is a beacon. Unless the pilots get smart and turn the radars off, they've given the enemy a major boost by telling them who they are and where they are, and a homing beacon for the anti-radiation missiles on which the Russians and the Chinese specialize. Unfortunately, we don't practice this thoroughly in exercises. We use the F-22 only on its strong points, and it runs up these big scores.
That's Winsor Wheeler of the Center for Defense Information, also with me, Mackenzie Eaglin of The Heritage, Mark Thompson of Time Magazine. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in for Diane. We'll be back with your call. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which provides solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thousands of chimpanzees live in the U.S. in research labs, zoos, and sanctuaries. How one journalist's encounter with a former circus chimp helped him understand the bonds between man and ape. The Diane Rehm Show next hour. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. Our subject this hour, the F-22, the high-tech fighter, that big debate in the Senate today. Will be a vote later today on whether to spend several billion dollars on further procurement of that aircraft. Winslow Wheeler of the Center for Defense Information is with me. Mackenzie Eaglin of the Heritage Foundation, Mark Thompson of Time Magazine. We have several emailers emailing similar questions. This is Mark from Little Rock. Does the Air Force want the F-22 or not? I don't hear a lot of outcry from the military on this issue. All I hear are analysts from conservative think tanks and Congress. Isn't this just a matter of Congress trying to keep big contracts for their districts? What's the answer, your best answer, Mark, here?
Well, plainly, the prior leadership of the Air Force wanted more F-22s. They were fired last year by Secretary Gates with the approval of President Obama after some nuclear component snafus. But this issue played a big role in it, plainly. These guys wanted more, more, more. They came from a fighter pilot background. And the new guy is a cargo and a special operations pilot, and basically he's more in tune with Gates' thinking. Whether that's right or wrong isn't so important as the notion that elections have consequences.
And McKenzie, the Secretary of the Air Force, Secretary Donnelly, was quoted this morning by Senator Enzi, an important Republican from Wyoming. He said, I asked him, does the Air Force need and want this plane? And he said, Secretary Donnelly said, no, we don't need it. We don't want it. And Enzi said, I'm going to vote against it because of that. Now, but there are uniformed officers in the Pentagon who take a different view.
Well, actually, Secretary Donnelly's argument was a bit more nuanced. He basically said, if we have to take that money from other competing priorities within the Air Force budget, that puts us in a different situation. The chief of staff of the Air Force, the uniformed military service member, said before the House Armed Services Committee, 243 F-22s is the right number. He said before the Senate, 243 is the military requirement. So does the Air Force want more F-22s? Absolutely. Can they afford them? No. So what this really is a debate about an inadequate Air Force top line. And the service members have basically told Congress, not basically, they just flat out have told Congress, we're not getting enough money. And this has been not just this chief, of course, but the previous ones as well.
What's your take on this question?
McKenzie's right about that. There's lots of true believers in the Air Force for the F-22. No question about it. The leadership has been disciplined by Secretary Gates, and I don't know what Mr. Donnelly's real personal views are when he talks to his dog at night, but he's probably biting his lip when he's signing these letters and saying what he's being told to say. McKenzie is right about, there's a lot of enthusiasm for this airplane in the Air Force. My only last point is, when was the last time the United States Air Force designed a highly successful fighter? By my count, that year was 1949 when they came out with the F-86. All the fighters since then have either been dogs or designed by outside parties like the fighter mafia who designed the F-15, the F-16, A-10, etc. We need to be careful about what we're advocating here.
Okay, let's go to some callers. Diane in Little Rock, Arkansas. You're on the Diane Rehm Show. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I would like the panel to answer this question if they know how much more money do we spend on defense than any other countries in the world. I believe it's 2 or 3 times more than any other country in the world, but maybe they can answer that for me. So,
okay, thank you.
I have one more comment if I can.
Go ahead.
We're talking about trillions of dollars in fighter planes. At the same time, we're having a debate in Congress whether we can afford health care for our citizens, which is a lot less cost than we're talking about fighters that we do not need.
Thank you, Diane, very much for your call. First question, how much?
The 2010 defense budget, including nuclear weapons, is $680 billion. The latest estimate I've seen for the next biggest spender is China at $120 billion. We're multiples of that. We're a tiny bit less than the rest of the world combined on defense spending.
Now, but the second part of the question, Mark, this debate today takes place in a context of larger budget questions. You got a $1.8 trillion deficit, which looms over this debate. And as the caller points out, part of the calculation Congress has to make, it's not just allocating money within the defense budget, but within the larger national budget.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to realize in terms of how do we compare that the world's second largest air force is flown by the U.S. Navy. I mean, we need to keep that in mind. The U.S. Air Force does not operate by itself. It operates with its sister services as well as with other countries. And then it is important to note that the Pentagon pot There's no reason it has to be a pot. That money can be expended elsewhere. The funds are fungible. And as the nation proceeds into the future, it needs to check out and ensure that it is putting its money in the right places. And is, you know, military now is 3.5 to 4% of GDP. Is that the right amount? Some folks say that the 4% of GDP should be a floor. And that sort of doesn't make much sense because then you're not paying so much attention to the threats. But that's where we are right now. About $1 out of every 25 the nation spends goes to our military.
Let's talk to David in Fort Worth, Texas. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show, David.
Hi. Thank you very much. First, just briefly, I'd like to address Diane from Little Rock. She said that we're spending trillions on this. This is a question of $1.75 billion for these additional planes when the health care bill is $1,000 billion, that's a trillion. But the comment I wanted to make regarding the fact that it hasn't been deployed as a strike against it is it's a spurious argument. First of all, we're talking about counterinsurgency and close air support in our current wars, and that's not the mission that the F-22 was designed for. And to assume that that's the mission that we're always going to face is downright dangerous. I mean, to assume that China or North Korea or even Russia will always have peaceful intentions towards us, is it really sets the stage to allow us to lose our strategic edge. And finally, why deploy a weapon system in a theater which it's not really required for, when that simply provides an opportunity for the major foreign powers to, once it's deployed, start gathering intelligence on its capabilities?
Thank you, David. Mackenzie, you were making a similar argument.
Sure. I mean, that's an excellent point that he raises. I mean, the vast majority, somewhere in the neighborhood of 80% of all of today's fighter sorties in both Iraq and Afghanistan conduct intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance missions, not strike. So it would make sense that you want to use your legacy aircraft to do that, F-15, F-16, primarily. You know, the F-22 was built for today's conflict. I referenced earlier that it was requested to be used, but it's also for tomorrow's fight, as the Air Force in this budget actually seeks to retire 250 of its legacy older fighters. It will increasingly rely on the F-22 for the next 40 years for air superiority.
What's the argument or the analysis that's behind our call or behind your point? That you've mentioned China several times, our caller mentioned other potential foes. Is there evidence that potential foes are developing aircraft that would necessitate an F-22 to counteract?
A common lexicon is that the Chinese and the Russians are developing fourth plus and fourth plus plus fighters right now. I referenced the fact that the U.S. will only have one tactical fighter production line in just a few short years. And between the two countries, China and Russia, they have over 12 fighter and bomber production lines. Both countries have indicated they will pursue fifth-generation fighter technologies, if not sixth, in the near future. Russia's is in just about 5 years, according to its planned budget projections.
Mark?
Yeah, according to U.S. intelligence, by the year 2020, the United States will have 1,000 fifth-generation fighters. Nobody else in the world will have any except those that we've sold to. The key thing on the F-22 is, think of it as an umbrella or as a shield. How big should this umbrella be? What the Air Force wants is for each of its 10 Air Expeditionary Forces to have its own squadron of 24 F-22s, wherever that AEF has to go or what it has to do. But with our bombers and with our spy planes, we don't assign them organically to these 10 mini air forces. They go there as they're needed. And a fair question can be asked, should we deploy the F-22 in the same way? In other words, give each person an umbrella instead of building a mammoth shield over the entire world. Then the requirements change dramatically.
Let's turn to James in Baltimore, Maryland. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us on the Diane Rehm Show, James.
Hi, thanks. I actually have two comments. I guess first, in terms of, the rise of unmanned aerial vehicles, I guess that they are low risk for human pilots, not only in survivability, but they can also pull faster and more dangerous maneuvers. They're also low risk in development, in that like the time to market is much faster for new drones and new design modifications for those drones. I guess my second comment is to ask the panel, what are our our plans on selling the F-22 to our allies as well as to questionable regimes? The F-15 and the F-16 have been sold throughout the world. What are our plans to sell it to other countries?
Thanks for your call, Winslow.
On the drones, these drones we're flying now don't do much or anything for maneuvers, and they're very easy to shoot down. But my fundamental problem with them these days is how we're using them. We think we get a free ride on launching these attacks in Pakistan, and we're causing a real disaster both for ourselves and for any stability in that region by the civilians we're killing with these drones. It's caused a huge reaction. It's a huge mistake. The future of aircraft, I sure as heck hope, isn't drones. The human element is so vital in reacting to unfolding events in the air that a drone fighter is a great idea for the other side. I hope the other side develops lots of drones for fighters.
Mackenzie, what about the second point, plans for sales?
Sure. I have a paper on this allied variant of the F-22 online at heritage.org, which will go into more detail for the caller.
Good,
but basically, Japan and Australia in particular have been the most interested in purchasing the F-22. Japan's defense ministry has studied the problem and has a compelling tactical rationale for pursuing this. And Congress has shown some reticence over the last 10 years to waive the Obi Amendment, the legislation that currently blocks the development of this allied variant, in part because we did give away so much of our technology with our legacy fighters overseas, and that has proliferated. There is some renewed interest this year, and I think after today's vote on the whether to purchase more F-22s, Congress may actually concede an allied variant to keep that production line open as opposed to the U.S. buying more.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's turn now to Deep in Great Falls, Virginia, if I have your name correct. I hope so.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, I appreciate getting on the air. I'm in the medical field, and we use evidence-based practices to perform procedures and get results in our individual patients based on hard data. We are funding things in the defense industry which have been proven not to work very well, and in today's economic environment, why does this persist?
Mark, this is a question that's come run through our entire discussion this morning.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of inertia in anything that spends $500 billion a year. And plainly, there are certain moments, like the first Gulf War was one, when all of a sudden precision-guided munitions were all the rage. And now they are an overwhelming share of our inventory. In the same way, the replacement of manned aircraft by unmanned aircraft is now looming. It's a turning point. So they do get it, but it just takes them a while sometimes.
But it is, and the call it raises, in drawing the analogy with the medical field, we're seeing in the debate over health care that every dollar in the federal budget has a defender. And he can talk about scientific and medical analysis, but the fact is the hospitals, the doctors, the pharmaceutical companies all will defend payment practices and formulas that work for them. And it's the same thing that's happening in the defense industry. There's no such thing as an undefended dollar.
That's right. I mean, if you want to know what's going on in the Air Force, you ask a Marine pilot because, boy, they really know what's going on with their brethren in the skies. And in the same way, there are different people pulling at different slices of that defense budget
the
time.
This is the real problem we've got. We've got the highest level of spending since World War II and the smallest, oldest military. We go into this at great length in our anthology, America's Defense Meltdown. It's not an easy question, and the solution is not easy. But the first step to stepping away from our decades-old problems is to stop building these F-22s.
Let's turn to Bernie in Frisco, Texas. Bernie, welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Yes, good morning, and
good morning.
Thank you. As I listen to this, I hear the word sometimes, national security, but living in Texas, I hear it all the time. You've just about convinced me as a panel that the national security of the United States does not depend upon at all having more F-22s. I mean, that's the conclusion that I draw listening to all of you and listening to the nuances. It's complex, it's interesting, but the national security of the United States will not be imperiled if we stop buying F-22s. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Mackenzie, you obviously disagree with that conclusion, though.
Well, in part for a couple of reasons, of course. Our military is a global military. It's asked to do things no other nation on earth is supposed to do, and that includes defeating or deterring enemies everywhere else from engaging them here, but at home over U.S. skies, including those in Texas. The Air National Guard chief has said that actually he needs more F-22s to perform the air sovereignty alert mission that basically was instituted after 9/11 that basically secures the skies from any enemy aircraft. Just as the 9/11 attacks were perpetrated, the Guard does not have enough fighters to perform this mission now. And it only gets worse for the next 5 years. And so if you ask your military commanders who fly over Texas, the answer is yes.
What's your take on Bernie's question, Bernie's conclusion?
Basically, Steve, the cancellation or killing of any one weapon system is never going to hurt the United States. This country's military is way too powerful. I mean, the notion that Air National Guard is saying we need more F-22s to defend our country, the Oregon Army National Guard chief told the Air Force Association last week that more F-22s were imperative because of the threat of offshore enemy cruise missiles being fired toward United States cities. For those of us who have been around for a while, after President Reagan began the Strategic Defense Initiative, the jealous Air Force began the Air Defense Initiative, which was supposed to stop that same threat, which withered and died.
Final word, Winslow. What's your reaction to Bernie's conclusion?
I agree with him completely. And Gates, so does Secretary Gates. He said it was preposterous to think that the fate of our defenses relied on 60 airplanes. 60 bad airplanes.
Final word. How do you think the vote's going to go today, Mark?
I think the president will pull it out narrowly.
Well, we'll come back and revisit it on another program. That was Winslow Wheeler of the Center for Defense Information. Mackenzie Eaglin, first time on the show. We're happy to have you, Mackenzie, from the Heritage Foundation. And Mark Thompson, defense correspondent of Time Magazine. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. And thanks so much for spending your morning with us.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones.